Today, scientists have been in a race to discover everything they can about COVID-19. In the 5 months since we first heard about this disease, how much have they found out and what do we still not know?
The COVID-19 virus is a tiny little sphere riddled with spikes. It's only about maybe 80 to 100 billionths of a metre diameter. But, you know, it's gone past every single defence mechanism that the planet has.
For months now, we've all been talking about little else than that tiny bundle of genetic material the Observer's science editor, Robin McKee, is describing.
Now, how does it affect people? You breathe it in droplets. These droplets come when people cough, typically. Maybe when they speak loudly, possibly when they shout. There's even evidence that maybe when you sing. And these droplets spray in the air. Now, should you breathe in some of these droplets, they will go to the back of your throat. And the back of your throat is lined with things called ACE2 receptors. And the little virus latches onto these receptors and insert their RNA into the cell that's lining your throat and infect them. It hijacks the genetic machinery of your cells and makes countless versions of itself. These break out the cells and start spreading the infection.
We all know at least part of what can happen next. COVID-19 attacks the lungs. From start to finish, it is a process that has laid down one of the most difficult challenges to face scientists in decades. They've had just months to try to discover everything they can about a scientific process that has brought the world to its knees.
As Bill Gates says, don't worry about nuclear war. A pandemic like this, it's going to do much more damage.
If anything kills over 10 million people in the next few decades, it's most likely to be a highly infectious virus rather than a war.
And that's what that tiny little kind of ball of RNA and lipids has done.
COVID-19 hasn't killed 10 million, but it has killed hundreds of thousands. And we've only known about it since December. In the 5 months since then, what have scientists found out? And what do we still not know? From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, the scientific race to understand COVID-19. Robin, you've been science editor for 38 years. You've covered lots of diseases and coronaviruses among them. They're not new, are they?
At least two coronaviruses are endemic in the British population and may have caused past epidemics. There is even a suggestion that the great Russian flu epidemic that hit the world in 1890 was caused by the coronavirus OC43. So we have not necessarily known about them, but we have had learned to live with them, as it were. But it's not for hundreds of years in some cases.
Right, but I guess we've come to understand them better in recent decades, and in particular during the SARS outbreak in late 2002 and 2003. Now, that coronavirus, SARS, was actually way more deadly than COVID-19, wasn't it? And yet, we were talking about worldwide hundreds of deaths, not hundreds of thousands. Why?
10% of the people who get that virus die. It's less than 1% in COVID-19. So that when you got SARS, you got very, very ill and you had a 1 in 10 chance of dying, you were immediately hospitalised, put into, very careful wards. And so you stopped infecting other people. You were isolated. And so the disease essentially just burnt itself out. It disappeared because it couldn't transmit itself to other people. And with COVID-19, that is not the case. For a start, lots of people are asymptomatic. Lots of people out there don't even know they ever had it. Secondly, it is quite clear that in a lot of cases, people are breathing out droplets containing the virus, before they come down to the disease themselves. So, I mean, that's a double whammy. That's bad news in terms of spreading. Great for the virus. It spreads itself around the planet. Whether or not it kills its host is actually not an issue. It's collateral damage as far as it's concerned. I make it sound as if it knows what it's doing. Of course, it's a tiny strip of genetic material, and that's all it does.
Do we know where COVID-19 comes from?
They come from bats. Bats have an immune system that's incredibly adept at killing off viruses that attack it. And so viruses that attack bats also are very adept at trying to get past these incredibly good defences. So when it's passed to some other creature and adapts to that host, you've got quite a dangerous pathogen on your hands. It's clear bats gave this to some other creature, possibly a pangolin. Both bats and pangolins are kept in markets in China, and the surmise is that somehow it changed in going from the bat to the pangolin, and then inside the pangolin changed and became something that was adept at infecting human beings.
And of course, not just adept at infecting people and killing quite a few of them, but adept at spreading and fast. When it became clear that COVID-19 had that terrible combination, it felt as though scientists entered a race against time to understand the disease, how quickly it moved through populations, and how to prevent and cure it. How far have we advanced?
We're on a learning curve. I mean, don't forget, we didn't know this virus existed 5 months ago. I find the level of knowledge and expertise that we've built in that time extraordinary. There are scientists who have been studying coronaviruses. This was their speciality. But by and large, any scientist who has had anything remotely to do with this has jumped. I mean, you could consider the issue of the Francis Crick Institute in London. I mean, that is Britain's premier biomedical research centre. Head of it is Sir Paul Nurse, Nobel Prize winner.
What we see here with this pandemic is that you can't win it by slogans. You've got to do it by hard work, getting down there, getting the data back.
And he decided 3 months ago just basically to drop everything and focus totally on the coronavirus.
It won't necessarily happen in the next week. In fact, it won't. But we will eventually beat it. There's no question about that. I just can't tell you quite how long it will take.
So let's go through what the scientists have discovered and what they still need to find out, starting with the disease itself. You've described what we know, how the virus enters the body, latches onto cells and replicates. We think of it as a respiratory disease, but doctors have been quite shocked by some of the things they've seen, haven't they? And it doesn't just affect the lungs.
What we don't know is all sorts of issues about why it affects certain people more than others. Then there are the issues of people, it causes thrombosis, it causes kidney complaints, it causes strokes in a small number of cases. Then there's the issue of this sort of happy hypoxia, where you find people whose air supply has been seriously disrupted by the damage done by the COVID-19, and yet they seem to have no problems, they seem perfectly well.
They call it happy hypoxia. Some COVID-19 patients with dangerously low levels of oxygen are not in distress at all. In fact, instead of gasping for air like you'd expect, they're making phone calls, they're chatting with hospital workers.
A complete baffling situation for scientists, and one that, who knows, when you look at it and you find the reason for it, may have some medical benefits for treating other conditions.
The next hugely important question for scientists is how it spreads. How have they gone about trying to figure that out?
Right. I mean, they basically studied the way that people speak, how people cough, people sneeze, studied the droplets that you expel, how far do they go, how hard do they have an impact. The droplets tend to be quite big and will carry quite a significant viral load, i.e. that's just the scientific term for the amount of virus you have. But there's also a sort of smaller aerosols travel with it. Now, the droplets won't go very far, they're just heavy and fall to the ground. Aerosols will form a little miasma and do carry the virus particles. But do they carry enough to infect people? You need what is known as an infectious dose. You have to have a certain number of virus particles for the infection to take hold. We don't know what that is exactly. We don't know if aerosols hold it. So that is urgently going on. You know, scientists have got, you know, machines in which they can create little clouds of aerosols and hold them and study them and see how many particles they can, the virus particles can hold. These are sets experiments that are all going on at the moment.
So trying to understand how much COVID is carried in the much smaller particles we breathe out. Have they got any answers on that yet?
No, I mean, the question about is it transmitted by aerosols, i.e. the tiny particles that travel far, do these carry an infectious dose? I would say that we don't know yet.
One of the things you said early on is that you can even spread it by shouting or singing.
Several choirs went down with this. Over the March period, one in Amsterdam, one in Berlin, one in Yorkshire. And in each case, they'd had a rehearsal, and in some cases, several people lost their lives, and partners of choir members lost their lives. And they had been suggested by some scientists that perhaps singing expels the virus even further, and that's how these infections were being spread, even though there'd been a certain social distancing during the choir rehearsals. But scientists at Berlin suggest this is not the case and really point to the fact that they weren't really social distancing. And this was March, and this was when the virus had already taken hold in different countries. And it was also most probably, therefore, a matter of poor social distancing and gathering together as a big group that had done the damage.
Which you tend to do in a choir as well as sing.
Yes, exactly, exactly.
Do we know the extent to which COVID-19 spreads asymptomatically?
So it definitely does spread asymptomatically. There's no doubt about it. People fall ill, and then they find themselves have been in the company of somebody who's subsequently fallen ill. And so quite clear that it has a period, sometimes of a day or two, when it is spread. It's difficult to say how you might have passed it while you were asymptomatically, but mainly spread, you know, in households. That is the prime mode of transport, or on public transport. Those are the two dangerous things.
And obviously attached to that is the question of what happens with children if they don't have symptoms. Does that mean they won't spread the disease? We're going to be talking about this in tomorrow's episode, but when it comes to whether it's safe to open schools again, is there any certainty here? What does the science say?
The studies, for instance, in Australia showed that children under the age of 10 were responsible for only 8% of bringing the virus to a household. Whereas compared that with flu, it's 50% of infections that appear in households have come from the child.
Thus far, we haven't really found any good evidence that kids are driving the transmission of this virus within the home.
So by and large, it's not children who are bringing it into households. On the other hand, German research has shown that if a child does become infected, they have the same viral load as an adult. That doesn't necessarily make them just as infectious. And the British Medical Association got that slightly wrong and got into trouble about it. But it does show that they have the same potential to be infectious.
OK, we've talked about what it does to you and how it spreads. The next questions are, how can we prevent it and how can we treat it? Let's start with prevention. Obviously, one of the things we've heard about a lot is pretty basic. Things like washing your hands and wiping things with disinfectants. The ministers were initially mocked for repeating some of them.
So at the moment, the best thing people can do is make sure that they wash their hands.
Wash your hands, smash your hands.
Stop shaking hands.
I think it's very important to stress that it is still the case that the single most useful thing that we can all do to support our NHS to stop the spread of coronavirus is to wash our hands. Two times happy birthday, hot water and soap.
But are they effective?
Yes, I mean, they were the only measures they could really effectively offer. But washing your hands, you're nothing to beat it. I mean, and, you know, a full 20-second wash throughout the day with soap breaks. These are little virus particles are covered with lipids, and soap just breaks them up. So if you've got, if you have touch and you've got the virus on your hands, the worst thing you can do is, of course, is to rub your face. But it's incredibly difficult not to rub your face. So if you're washing your hands all the time, then that's, it is, no doubt about it, a great thing to do. Other measures that you can take, well, face masks. Well, the wearer of a face mask is not going to be protected particularly well from the virus. It's just a possibility that they might stop that wearer from infecting others. It will reduce the amount they expel. And I suppose every little counts. So if you say, well, if you're going to get on the tube, then you have to have a face mask. Might be good psychologically. On the other hand, it might be psychologically bad for you because you're wearing a face mask and you think you're immune and you're not.
It's kind of obvious why social distancing would work, but there's clearly a lot of debate around the details, whether it's 2 metres or 1 metre, indoors or outdoors, or the amount of time you stand by a person. Do we know whether any of those things make a difference?
No, we don't know. They're imposed because that's the best guess based on other viral studies. In terms of where you do it, outdoors is infinitely better than indoors. So being outdoors is a good thing and should be encouraged.
So those are all the preventative measures. But what about treatment? Presumably, there's been an absolute race to find a cure for this.
I mean, everybody is going at it. And there are all sorts of ideas. I mean, if the longer this goes on, I would expect to see the numbers of people dying in hospital from severe COVID-19 effects would go down because they're learning all the time just how to deal with the cases. For instance, blood thinning medicines are now being discussed as a prospect to stop the clots of blood in the lung. Antiviral drugs are also being talked about. But what people sometimes don't get is the fact that you will only ever find out the efficacy of a particular treatment if you compare it with when you don't give it. In other words, you have to have some kind of blind trial. We didn't give it in this case. We did give it in this case. And look, 77% of the people got better. And then you look at that and then you decide when you give it. But these blind trials take time. And it's the same for a vaccine. So we have lots of vaccine targets and talk of getting a vaccine up and running by September. But you have to realise that when you test a vaccine, you're just putting people out there and waiting to see how many of them get COVID-19. And ironically, if you've suppressed the prevalence of the virus in the population, there's much less chance of a person with or without the vaccine picking it up. So that delays your opportunity to find out whether it is this vaccine candidate works or not.
I was going to say, because there's huge ethical issues around this and we don't have time. If you're going to do a double blind test, you're basically saying to people with this disease, you are going to get a placebo treatment, or if you're waiting on a vaccine, you can't put people in the path of COVID-19 to test it, can you?
Well, there, of course, there are people who think you should. And these are the people who suggest that we have young volunteers, give them the vaccine or give them a placebo and then deliberately infect them with COVID-19. And these are, it's promoted by scientists, you know, in quite a few places. It's ethically questionable, but the benefits could be great. I'm not advocating it, but I know several scientists who do advocate it.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The argument from some people is they'll get young volunteers, you know, 20, 25, very strong, test them for any underlying conditions, give them the vaccine or the placebo, and then give them the virus. But there are all these cases where there have been unexpected side effects, and so you can't not face up to that issue.
Would you volunteer to get the coronavirus if it helped in developing a vaccine? It's a highly debated subject among ethicists. Normally,
but I mean, there are people who've offered to put themselves forward.
So basically, because if you're thinking about this in risk terms, the number of people under 30 who die even though it seems bad, is actually proportionally tiny.
It is, exactly. But we're asking once more, we're asking people to make sacrifices for the public good, as we asked healthcare workers, as we asked care home workers, and now we're just asking young people to take these risks on behalf of society.
Coming up, immunity could be the key to getting back to public life. We look at the questions still remaining when it comes to coronavirus antibodies. And what about natural immunity? Do we know that people definitely get antibodies? And do we know how much protection they offer them?
The issue about whether this disease triggers antibodies and how protective those antibodies are is wide open at the moment. All the evidence suggests that, yes, they do produce antibodies. And the question is, how protective are those antibodies? And that's where the jury is out. Most people who know coronaviruses think that it'll give us at least a year or two. That's the educated guess. And that's very, you know, that's maybe you would want one for life, but, you know, you'll settle for 1 or 2 years to start with. By that time, you hope you have a vaccine which confers, you hope, the similar immunity. But again, it will only be for 1 or 2 years. So this, when this settles down to be an endemic disease of the British people and the rest of the world, we're going to have to face outbreaks every so often, or just keep taking the vaccine every couple of years, if that's the kind of length of time that we are offered immunity by either natural infection or by the vaccine.
Robin, one of the things that strikes me as you have spoken to us is that there is far more that we don't know than that we know. And I think that's hard for people because we have this sense that science will offer us fact, certainty. But what's really clear as you watch this unfold is that it can't. When you talk to scientists, how much disagreement is there? How much is unknown?
I would say the scientists are not, they're not squabbling about various things. Epidemiologists squabble about it, I suppose, about how they see the thing unfolding in general terms. An epidemiologist is a statistician who try and works out the behaviour of a virus and human beings in general terms. In scientific terms, about the actual behaviour of the virus, no, I think they kind of say, well, this is what we don't know, this is what we don't know, this is what we don't know, and this is how we're trying to find it out. I still find it encouraging the way that scientists have responded to this.
How strange has this period been for science? Studies that normally would take years, be heavily peer-reviewed and might be quite complex, are suddenly being pored over by the public, splashed over front pages. Do you think it's confusing for people?
Yes, I think it is, because one study looks at one particular issue and another study looks at it a slightly different way. Going back to the issue of the German studies that showed that children just had the same amount of viral load as an adult, but other Australian studies which showed that children were less likely to infect a household than anyone else. Seemingly contradictory, but in fact, they just look at the disease from a very slightly different perspective. It's very hard sometimes for the public to get that. Very hard for us poor science editors to get it, for that matter. And you have to be, you know, very careful about how you interpret these findings.
Robin McKee, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Robin McKee, The Observer's science editor. You can follow his reporting at theguardian.com, including a look at what the science says about schools reopening, about the disease spreading within choirs, scientific questions about workplaces, the health impact of the disease, and a really good roundup on what scientists know so far. Now, before we go, I want to mention something that we heard in an episode a few weeks ago about acts of altruism happening around the country. We featured a nurse called Lucy Wellings who set up Tour de Thanks, a scheme that matches NHS workers with bikes to help them get to work. She's been in touch to say that if you are an NHS worker who needs a bike to get to work, or if you have a bike that you would like to loan, do check out at Tour de Thanks on Twitter or Instagram to find out more. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Mithali Rao and Josh Kelly. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.